week, we will have with us a fantastic program. We are going to have Rabbi Kenneth Brander, Rabbi Dr. Kenneth Brander, who's one of the world experts in fertility in halacha. And we're going to be speaking about halacha and the latest fertility treatments. My egg, my husband, somebody else's womb, whose child, the ethics of reproductive medicine, four-parent babies. And we're going to be speaking about egg freezings through the prism of halacha by one of the world experts in PGD, something really fascinating. We will be speaking again on the topic of DNR. And we will be speaking to Rabbi Lefkowitz of Chaim Aruchim. And this is important. Rabbi Lelson, you should never know this, but Chaim Aruchim is one of the go-to organizations for people who have an ill relative. And we will be speaking to Rabbi Gewurzman, who's one of the poskim of Chaim Aruchim, and be continuing our conversation about DNR. So, friends and listeners and participants with all the emails we get, something wonderful. Do you know that Headlines 2 is going to be published and going to be in your Sfarim stores in the next 2 weeks? It took around 2 years to write. I took 24 what I thought were the best, you know, episodes, programs that we had with the Rabbanim. We have, you know, Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, Rabbi David Cohn, Rabbi David Yosef, Rabbi Asher Weiss, their opinions, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, Rabbi Shmuel Kamenetsky, etc., etc. I took the Rabbanim who were on those programs from three continents, and I put it into, you know, with the article that, you know, created it, the article in the news, the first headlines, I believe the all-time bestseller of the OU. So this again is being published by the OU, which I guess if they kasher all our food, that means they're giving us a hechsher on this too. And it's exciting. It's going to look fantastic. And I think that if you want to have something to discuss over Pesach, and you're sitting chalamayit and you want to talk to your kids about something besides maybe Donald Trump, but you want to talk about an interesting halacha topic that will get your children, your friends, your neighbors interested in arguing, Jews love to argue, go out and get. We only published, the first run is only a few thousand. I'm sure they're going to sell out in a hurry before Yom Tov. So go to your Sfarim store and say, I want headlines too. You can listen to us, Matzah Shabbat, 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA or on 570 AM or on WMCA.com or on the Nachum Siegel Network, again on Monday morning at 11 a.m. at Nachum Siegel. You can listen to all our shows at headlinesbook.com under the audio or podcast section, or you can always call in at 732-806-8700. You can email any questions or comments to info@headlinesbook.com. I will at some point catch up. We have so many great emails and calls. We will catch up to them. We will try. Before we go to our program, I do like to say something about the Parsha. You know, this week it's the story of the Parah Aduma, one of those mysterious, it's a Shailava Daraisa, Safik Daraisa, it's very Chomer. What does the Parah Aduma mean to us? Parah Aduma, you know, it's just a red cat. What is a red eye for? What does that mean? So let me give you what I think is a really a powerful, modern, contemporary insight about the Parah Aduma and why we could all use a Parah Aduma. Parah Aduma was Parah Aduma Tmima, was whole. It couldn't have a mum, not a slightest blemish. Asher lo'yah le'ah oil. It was mighty. It was red. It was beautiful. It was special. It was rare. And it's destroyed. And think of it. Maybe all of us in our life at some point have had something that was dear to us that maybe was destroyed, lost, passed away, somebody we loved. Or maybe it was a shidduch or a financial opportunity. Maybe it was a friendship. Right? So what do? It says you take the ashes of the Parah Aduma and you sprinkle it on Mayim Chaim and it cleanses. It's metahir. Something amazing. Like, what does it mean? How does it work, this tahara? And the Gemara goes through, and the Rambam, all the incredible avoda of the Mayim, it had to be living water, and how they collected the water, and the type of kalim that they kept it in. Just very, what does all this mean? Well, if you look at the Haftarah, what does the Haftarah say? It says, "Zarakti alecha mayim tahirim." I will sprinkle on you mayim tahirim, utaharta mikol tumaisechem, venasati lechem lev chadash. I'll give you a new heart, v'ruach chadasha, a new spirit etein bekerbechem, v'asirosi es lev ho'even. I will remove that stone in your heart, or that stone heart. I will give you a new spirit, new life, and a new heart. That's what the Paraduma represents. How does it work? So let me tell you something interesting. You know, we all go through stresses in life, sadly. At some point in our lives, all of us go through stresses. It's inevitable. And there are different ways to react. Some people react with anxiety, depression. Rachman Altan Zviglok talks about suicide, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse. We've heard about substance abuse. And some people don't. They're resilient, and somehow we shrug, we walk away. But you know, there's a rare group of people, maybe 10%, who have something that psychology calls post-traumatic growth. They go through the trauma, and they come out richer. What is this? Somehow, they're able to take this loss and energize it and turn it into something positive. I once heard an expression from somebody. It said, don't let a loss ever go wasted. Don't let a setback be wasted. They're able to use that. You know, as we had on the program, something, a powerful story, one of the most powerful stories I ever had in my life, I ever heard. We had on Rabbi Eckstein. He founded Dar Yesharim. Dar Yesharim has wiped out Tay-Sachs and is on the way to wiping out many illnesses from our community. He said he lost 4 of his children, his first 5 children, to the Tay-Sachs disease. But what did he do? He didn't crumble and cry. He didn't curl up. He said, I will use this energy and I will eradicate Tay-Sachs from an entire nation. And when he spoke in our program, he said, there was one Tay-Sachs hospital in Brooklyn that took years to get into because Nachman Altan, the children die over a long period of time. And he said, I was there when they closed the hospital because there was nobody left. There were no more children of Tay-Sachs. What does that mean? Some people take post-trauma and they grow from it. They create from it. What do? We take the ashes of the most beautiful imaginable para, and we sprinkle it on the Mayim, on Mayim Chaim. We mechaber the trauma into Mayim Chaim, and we create Tahara. We create something beautiful. We say that that happened to me, you know what? That loss, it's live again. It's going to live forever. Rabbi Eckstein's 4 children live forever in all the children that he's created that are healthy. I'll tell you something on a personal note. My father, who I loved so much, he had cancer, and he was in Sloan off and on for a number of years. And I used to go there, and I'd walk through the hospital and see people sleeping, falling off chairs, and eating potato chips on Shabbos. There was no place near Sloan. And I said to myself, after my father was nifty, went to Olam Emes, I said, you know, I'm going to use this energy. And what did I do? I founded, and I don't say this out of pride, I'm using it just simply as I used this energy. We built the building next to Sloan that on a regular weeknight or weekday, you'll have 40 people staying there. That's taking ashes, sprinkling on Mayim Chaim and saying, we didn't take that loss. We didn't waste that loss. We turned it into Nitzchias. Think of how many people you can think of in your life. How many organizations were founded by somebody who went through that particular trauma? And what did they do? They brought it back to life. So the Gemara says in Kiddushin, I think it's on Daf Lamed Aleph, the Gemara says, there was a guy, his name was Dan ben Asina. And the Chachamim came to him. He had a gem they wanted to put in the Choshen, and it was under his father's pillow. And he didn't want to wake his father up, and he had a substantial loss. But he had tremendous kibbud av eim. So he said the next year, a paraduma was born to him. And the Chachamim came to him and he said, they said, and he said to them, I know You'll give me anything in the world for it. All I want is the money that you would have given me last year for my gym. So it's interesting. We can understand this great act he did. But why did Hashem bless him through a parah aduma? I mean, there are so many other things. It could have been another stone. It could have been from the ephod. Could have been a piece of gold. Does God missing ways to create riches for a person? But I think the answer is, what does the parah aduma represent? The loss that you think that beautiful thing lost, it doesn't have to be lost. It could be turned back into life, into something fabulous. Take that experience, become more enlightened, become more empathetic, become more humane. Do you know there's a doctor, Dr. Seligman, he says people who go through trauma and it doesn't break them, they come out as much greater human beings. They come out more enlightened, empathetic, smarter. They appreciate their lives more. So parah aduma says, take that loss and turn it into life. So what did Dhamma ben Asina say? He says, that money, I thought it was lost. They brought him the parah aduma. He said, I know what this means. Give me back the same money. I don't want this to be just some lottery ticket. The parah aduma says, you thought it was lost. It's not really lost. Rabbi Eckstein's children aren't gone. Four children, they turned into so many. The story of the parah aduma, and we listen to it every year. Let's make in our hearts a commitment. The commitment is the parah aduma today could still be alive today. I will take that beautiful thing that hurts me, and I will bring it back to life. I will attach it to Maim Chaim and create something beautiful from it. Let's go to our fabulous guests. Welcome, Rabbi Brander. Was the Rav of the Boca Raton Shul, which is one of the largest shuls in America. I think he took it from 60 to 600 mispalim when he left. I don't know where it's up to today. Welcome, Rabbi Brander.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and to share words of Torah with you.
So, Rabbi Brander, I understand that you're one of the experts in PGD, freezing eggs, some of the most modern, cutting-edge fertility shilas. Can you give us a little bit of a synopsis of, this chelik of Torah that you've spent so much time on?
Thank you very much. First of all, I wouldn't consider myself one of the experts. I've been blessed and privileged to learn from, I think, the expert in the Jewish world, Avraham Menachem Burstein Shlita from Eretz Yisrael, who is an unbelievable expert in this field, and I received Torah from him and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu Zatzal. We talk about the fact that the Torah recognizes that the gift of science is really the conduit through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us to actualize certain dreams, and one of those dreams for families is sometimes to be able to have children, or for young couples to be able to have children. And sometimes it's difficult. It doesn't happen as easy as we may always think. And there are these new, unbelievable opportunities that science has given us to allow couples who wish to have a family to celebrate that dream. Some of them include the fact that we're able to deal with forms of infertility that we were not able to deal with in the past, including the idea of fertilizing an egg outside the womb, which is called IVF, in vitro fertilization. With IVF comes something called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and that is the ability after the egg has, the fertilized egg, 3-4 days into its development to be able to pull one cell from the fertilized egg in the lab and to analyze that one cell to get a look into what is happening within that fertilized egg. So in case there are some genetic challenges, be it Tay-Sachs or any other challenges that are genetically based, you can know those challenges in advance and therefore only return fertilized eggs that do not have those genetic challenges. So couples that are concerned about certain genetic anomalies that they may carry together are now rid of that challenge through the gift of PGD.
So what genetic diseases can you now screen for because of PGD?
I mean, you can screen for any genetic challenges that someone may have. So there are a host of Ashkenazic and Sephardic genetic challenges that you can screen for, and PGD allows you to do so. But there are several other newer forms of gifts that science has given us to be able to deal with issues of fertility. So, like, for many years, we've been able to, for the longest time, we've been able to freeze sperm in case someone has certain, like, God forbid, they have cancer and they need to freeze sperm beforehand so that the drugs and the therapy that they have to go through doesn't affect their ability to have a man to have fertility challenges in the future. But most recently, in the past 2.5 years or so, we've been given the gift that we've never been able to do before, and that is to freeze oocytes, to freeze eggs. Because an egg, they were challenged in freezing it because the slow process of freezing an egg caused the cellular structure to be compromised. But lately, through a process called vitrification, we've been able to freeze an egg in a second, going from 98 degrees Fahrenheit to minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit in literally a second or less. So now, for the first time since actually 2012, we've been able to freeze eggs, which means that if, for example, a woman, Rahman al-Tlan, has a challenge of is having to deal with the issue of cancer, she's able to freeze eggs beforehand, so in case the treatments would affect her eggs, the eggs can be harvested in advance so that it wouldn't affect it. In case a woman is at a point within her life where she's not yet married and she's concerned that the biological time clock will compromise her ability to have children, she can freeze eggs beforehand. If she has certain other challenges, for example, a woman who has fragile X, which sometimes can cause a woman to go into menopause early, it can allow a woman to freeze those eggs so that if she has the challenge of fragile X, she's able to freeze eggs in her 20s so that in the future she'll be able to have children even though she might get into a state of early menopause. So these are gifts that science has allowed us to take advantage of, and obviously we have to be concerned about halachic issues and to make sure that when we embrace the science, we do it through the prism of Torah values.
So, but these Rabbi Brenda, what would be some of the halachic issues with freezing eggs?
Well, I think the larger issues are with any of these issues that, some of the halachic issues would include the following, that when you freeze eggs or freeze sperm or fertilize an egg, you need to make sure that it's done in an environment in which there is some form of hashkacha, because we don't want to create a situation where an egg is fertilized by a husband's sperm and we're not sure that the proper sperm and the proper egg are being used. All labs try to make sure that they're flawless and they have no challenges, but human beings are human beings. And having a second set of eyes to make sure that the proper sperm and the proper egg are being properly fertilized to make sure that the fertilized egg returned to the womb of the married woman is indeed her egg and her husband's sperm is something of critical importance. And therefore, most poskim really suggest, in the strongest of terms, that there be a process when an egg is retrieved or when sperm is expressed, and that it is frozen and stored, that there is a form of hashkacha. The same way there is hashkacha in other things that we do that needs to be hashkacha here, and at the time in which the egg is fertilized or PGD is done, that there's an extra set of eyes making sure that there is no mix-ups in any way, shape, or form.
So that is there SCA gene is sadly something that is, you know, an Ashkenazic community particularly is more prevalent. Can we screen for the BRCA gene?
We can screen for various different mutations. I'm not a medical expert to know for sure if you can screen for the BRCA mutation. You'd have to ask a doctor that. But sometimes, for example, when someone has the BRCA mutation with a certain family history, and it's recommended that they go through some type of prophylactic oophorectomy, which means removing of ovaries, which causes an induced menopause. The idea of being able to freeze eggs in advance helps to make sure that a woman who's having this challenge due to her family history can freeze eggs, can have her own genetic children, and still make sure that she's taking care of her best health. So that's an example, the BRCA mutation. Well, in the past, if a woman acted upon the BRCA mutation, they were unable, once they went through this process, to have their own genetic children. Now, with the ability to freeze eggs, you can have you can become pregnant afterwards.
Rabbi Brandel, let me ask you, have the Paiskim opined on the following question? If somebody has, Rachman Olatzan, genetically one of these genes, so I know the Marshal, the Mechaber, in Evan Ezra Simon Bay says, somebody should marry into the family of Nichfim because you don't want to bring damaged children to the world. Would there be a halachic obligation if somebody has a serious family genetic disease to undergo PGD rather than having a child in the normal way? Would it be halachically mandated upon you? You have to, now that science has introduced it, you do not have a right to bear children regularly when there is a X percent chance, a significant chance that the child would have Tay-Sachs, you name the list of horrible diseases. Would you say that it's an obligation, or is it just a sort of an option?
I think that there are many poskim who have opined on this. I think many of the poskim have felt that in cases of this nature that they should do PGD because of the fact that you can save a family from going through a whole bunch of significant challenges. Why not try to do that? I mean, Rav Shlomo Zalman, there's a statement from Rav Shlomo Zalman on this issue about how to deal with issues like this, even though Rav Shlomo Zalman wasn't alive when the PGD and others were able to happen, but he creates the parameters for this where he permits certain activities if it stops one from being able to have children that have certain genetic challenges, and therefore it would apply in this case, and Nishmas Avraham brings down the comments of Rav Shlomo Zalman. So it would seem to me that in cases in which we're not doing PGD in order to decide whether your child's going to be male or female, which is another thing, obviously, PGD can tell you whether the child will be male or female. There, I think, there are poskim that permit that also, but there, I think, we have to be careful not to becoming where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's junior partners. We're not God, and therefore we have to be careful about doing things of that nature. But when it comes
would it be mutter, Rabbi Brenda, if a family had seven or eight, they wanted of a particular, they had seven boys or seven girls, and they wanted the eighth one to be a boy or a girl, can they go to a doctor, logically say, listen, let's take 10 eggs, fertilize them, or number one of them is going to be the opposite gender, and that's the one we implant. Would that be halachically permissible?
So I don't think they would have to take 10. They would probably have to take a lot less than that. 10 is a lot to be fertilized. And I think that anyone on this radio show should ask their posek. There are definitely poskim that would permit it in order to be mekayim the mitzvah pru revu. And there are other poskim that would suggest that a Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't ask us to be mekayim the mitzvah. A Kadosh Baruch Hu asks us to try to do our best. And PGD would not be something that would be required. Again, the Gemara, and speaks about being mekayim the mitzvah apur revu, it says asakta b'piruvivivivya, which means did you try to fulfill the mitzvah apur revu, not kiyamta piruvivivivya, did you fulfill it? But I think that the same poskim who might be concerned about doing that for a male or female child would definitely encourage PGD to be done when there is a significant chance that you would be bringing a child into the world that would have a very stressful life because of genetic anomalies, especially when we live at a time in which by doing PGD, you can remove that stress for the rest of the family, for that child, and making sure that child lives a rich life. Not to say that children with genetic challenges don't live rich lives, but we all know that it's a little bit more challenging, and we have the capacity to remove those significant challenges in our day and age.
So, Rabbi Brander, can you talk about the halachic issues if somebody's fertilized 4 or 5 eggs and they select one that they want? Two questions, very similarly related. Is there a halachic problem with disposing of those eggs, being that it potentially could be a human, right? And additionally, let me ask you the following question. If, let's say, those eggs were in a freezer and the electric went out, would it be mutter to be Michal Shabbos to save the egg, to save these embryos?
Those are wonderful questions. We have to remember that an egg that has just been fertilized is considered, no matter how long it's been frozen for, it's considered in the category of less than 40 days, which means that we consider it as maya ba'alma, like a sack of water. And therefore, the Rishonim asked that if a woman who's pregnant, less than 40 days, can you violate the Shabbos for that early stage of pregnancy? And the poskim, the Rishonim poskim, that you can, because since the fertilized egg, albeit in those early stages, is in the womb, you have the capacity, eventually it will grow into a fetus, and eventually the fetus will grow into, please God, a child, and therefore you're permitted to violate Shabbos, which is not technically a violation. If you're permitted, you're permitted to violate Shabbos in order to allow this child to eventually celebrate Shabbatot for the rest of his or her life. But the poskim are very clear. This permission to be able to violate the Shabbos when the fetus is less than 40 days old, which means it's not yet called a fetus, it's just maya ba'alma, a sack of water, is only because it is in the womb, and therefore it is in the location where it will eventually grow into a fetus. Therefore, a fertilized egg that's in a laboratory and the power goes out, you can't violate the Shabbos to save that fertilized egg, because it is not yet something that's a bar kayama. It has no potential to grow into a fetus, and it has no potential to go from a fetus into a child. So you would not be permitted to violate the Shabbos in an active way to do it. You might be permitted to do some forms of Amir La'akum because there's Hefzid Meruba and things of that nature. But for the standard issues that we've discussed in the past, the standard issues that are the reason why we would violate Shabbos for a woman who's pregnant would not apply.
Now,
the second issue,
Rabbi Brenda, I understand that they now are doing it in England. They reported it, but it's becoming more commonplace, where they can take the egg of a woman who is not able to have children because she has mitochondrial issues, open up an egg, this atomic-sized egg, and implant a mitochondria or other, parts of a healthy woman's egg, in effect creating an egg that has two mothers of two women. Now, if this egg were fertilized and the child were born, would you say the child has two mothers? Halachically, how would you look at it? Or alternatively, if one day they're able to do this with a sperm, would you say, can a child halachically have two mothers or two fathers?
That's a wonderful question. I think let me just put the science into context for a second. The nucleus of an egg has 20,000 genes, and the mitochondrial of an egg, the mitochondrial has 37 genes. And therefore, they did this in the United Kingdom, where they removed the mitochondria of the egg and switched it with healthy mitochondria, so that the egg itself was really the product of two genetic contributors, of two women. So you can have a situation where you have a gestational carrier, a woman that carries the fetus, and you can have two other mothers who are the genetic donors. So essentially you can have not just two mothers, but three mothers. And there the poskim have a serious conversation at this point of time of who is the mother. There are many poskim that say that the mother is the gestational carrier, the one who carries the fetus. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, in an article in Tchumim, discusses that. And there are many poskim who suggest, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik felt that way. There are many poskim who feel that the genetic donor is the donor. Rav Yashiv, towards the end of his life, wrote a piece that seemed to indicate that he felt that the genetic donor is the donor. And there are many other poskim that feel that way. Rabbi Willig Shlita from Yeshiva University, from Yeshiva's Ben Yitzchak Ochanan, feels that way. So there is a machlokus within the poskim. So we first have to answer the question of who's the mother, the gestational carrier or the genetic donor. And then we have to decide who is, if there are two genetic donors, who is the mother within that. So I think that it's important to recognize that there is a serious machlokus in the poskim, and therefore if one of the mothers, the gestational mother, or this genetic mother isn't Jewish, most poskim, including Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, feel that you should do Geirus L'Chumra in order to make sure you cover all your bases. Regarding the issue of between those two mothers, I would suggest, even though there's nothing really that has been written on this yet, since it's so recent, it's just a few months old, the wonderful question that you asked, I would suggest that since the mitochondrial DNA holds so little of the genetic matter, only 37 components of it, whereas the nucleus of egg has 20,000 genes, that the definition of maternity, if it is the genetic carrier, it would be the owner of the nucleus of the egg, not of the mitochondrial DNA of the egg.
Now, well, let's say they would figure out, yeah, there will come a time we'll do this to the nucleus too, and then what would you think?
Then Baruch Hashem, we have significant poskim in the world, and we'll have to turn to them for guidance. I would then say the same thing I said before, that once we get to a point where you can have multiple mothers, and one of them is not Jewish, you would definitely have to do Geirus L'Chumra. And it will become a serious conversation amongst the poskim whether we should engage in such a genetic manipulation or not.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Branda, for this is the most cutting edge of fertility issues that we have in the world. I'm sure they'll change. It's very fascinating, and I thank you on behalf of all our listeners for sharing your knowledge in this matter.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and your service that you're doing is so important because Torah needs to be able to engage and embrace the most cutting-edge issues, because it is Kiim Chayenu Varech Yomenu. It is a living Torah, and the fact that we're able to embrace and discuss these cutting-edge issues just celebrates the Nitzrius, the eternality of what Torah is all about.
Thank you very much. Take care, everybody. I'm so happy to share with you that Headlines 2 is going to be on the Sfarim shelves around Rosh Chodesh Nisan in around 2 weeks. There's not that many of them. We did the first run. It was a rush. So you better grab them if you want to have something interesting to talk about Pesach. Besides talking about all the local politics, etc., Trump, Aher, Rahin, Kushner, Trump, talk about something halacha, an interesting. We took 24 of the most interesting shows that got really a lot of hits from, you know, our listeners love them, with the greatest Rabbanim, and we put them into learning the Sfaris, the Gemaris, the different opinions, the Machoikis. So sit down by the table and surprise your teenager who thinks he knows everything and thinks that you're really out of touch, and hit him with a question and watch his mouth open and saying, what? Pop? Mom? You know issues like this? Really? You can discuss such current issues and make your Pesach, your Yom Tif, your Seder, your Chalamoid, your weekday, you should have something to say. When you go to a chasana, say, you know, I have a really interesting question. So go out and get it. You'll recognize most of the topics if you've been listening. Headlines, too. It's in your Sfarim store. Discuss end-of-life issues. Let's go to our guests. Rabbi Yaakov with us from Lakewood, New Jersey. Rabbi Eliezer Wertzman, who is the Rav of Chaim Arutz, The number, by the way, is 718 Aruchim. And as somebody who's unfortunately experienced this recently, knowing how difficult it is to get a Rav sometimes on the phone during a crisis with somebody you love who's, in some type of, end of life situation, what a tremendous chesed Aruchim does that they're available. So, Rabbi Eliezer, let me ask you a few questions and you'll respond as you see fit. So, you have a terminally ill, or not necessarily an end of life, an older person, it's towards the end of their life. And it comes a question, put on them on a ventilator when there's a strong likelihood they will not get off the ventilator, or force feed, intubate, so that the person can stay alive, even though there is no hope of recovery. What is Chaim Aruchim Paskin? If somebody were to call you in that situation, what do you say?
First of all, Shalom Aleichem, Rav David, thank you very much for having me. The answer to that question is it's a very broad question. The first question we really have to ask when somebody calls with that particular question is that really the reality that this person cannot get off a respirator? Very often, people are told that their loved one cannot get off a respirator based on presumption of age or some other reason why the doctor feels that this may not be the case. So the first thing that we would always do at Chaim Aruchim is to try to figure out why is this patient being put on a respirator, and based on the information we have and with the medical staff that we have, to try to establish whether that's actually the case, that this patient cannot get off a respirator. And very often, we will find that even with older people, the assumption just is that this patient can't get off a respirator because in the medical world, if they have what we would call a Safek Pikuach Nefesh, they look at it and they say, look, if this patient can't get off a respirator, or maybe won't get off a respirator, don't put him on because you don't want to chas v'shalom have him get stuck on the respirator. And by us, it's obviously the opposite. If there's a possibility that this patient could get off a respirator, then we would be mechuyev to put him on the respirator and then deal with the consequences afterwards, even if ultimately he did get stuck. I just want to mention that in the last few years, there's been a lot of progress made to be able to get patients off a respirator. There's facilities called LTACs that have come on the scene in the last 5 years that specifically do respiratory therapy to help patients get off a respirator, where in a hospital they'll just try to take out the machine and see how the patient does. In some of these facilities, they'll actually check. So the first thing that we do at Chaim Aruchim is really establish what the story is. The more difficult questions start becoming when you have an elderly patient that is really potentially could be on a respirator and does not have a likelihood of getting off, specifically an end-stage cancer patient where the lung cancer has spread already throughout the lungs. That is a question that in certain instances we at Chaim Aruchim and many other rabbanim maybe would not require a patient to go on a respirator. But I must reiterate again that a family must consult with a Rav who's an expert who has a Messiah on this before jumping to conclusions. And the more difficult question becomes when a patient, because of a blocked airway and so on, may be able to live a very long time on a respirator. In that case, we usually would require that the patient go on the respirator, even though they don't have the likelihood of getting off.
But isn't it a machlokes ha'poskim? I believe Reb Feivel Cohen is quite machmir, and he believes you can almost never not put a person on a respirator and prolong life, whereas Reb Shlomo Zalman and Reb Moshe Feinstein believe that you could. I mean, how does Chaim Aruchim Paskin in such a situation?
So again, each situation is different. Chaim Aruchim does allow in certain cases to allow a patient not to go on a respirator, but these cases are so delicate and there are so many
Variables.
Variables, and in each patient to figure out what's going on. And then very often the Shiloh will come up and will say, okay, today do as follows. The next day they call, there's a whole new set of circumstances.
So can you try to give us a little bit of like, what do you teach your Rabban and what are the rules of the road?
So the rules of the road very specifically are that we have to get, the most important thing is to get down to the bottom of the facts, which is obviously a lot of times very, very difficult to do. And what I would say is in certain very end stage patients, especially if there's a lot of tsar, that's
pain.
The time. Yeah, with his pain. That's where we start.
You're basing that on Ramesh's. You're basing this, I believe, on Ramesh's psak, is that he says that they based on the Ran that says that if somebody's in great pain, you could be mispal for their death. So Ramesh makes the kal v'chomer. He says, for sure, if you could be mispal for their death, certainly you don't have to do something to prolong their life. Is that what you're basing it on?
Not 100% based on that. It's more based on the Ramah.
The Ramah that talks about removing salt, yeah.
Right, so over there, the Ramah says that a person is not obligated to prolong what we would call, let's say, the death process. Now, it's a very difficult question because today things change very much from those days, where in those days a person, there wasn't that much they could do for them. Today, very often they could put a patient on a respirator and they could live for a week or two or three. So it becomes a very difficult question as to what and to when. Very often some of these life-saving measures that people would like to do could also put the patient in sakana, and that has to be taken into consideration as well.
So one thing you're saying is if the person is in extreme pain, you would possibly in that situation not allow for you would sign a DNR, or alternatively, let's discuss the Ramah Lama test. Ramah, I believe, says, he makes a chilek. He says you're not allowed to cause the death of a person, but if there is something where the person would naturally die, and there is something that preventing the death, you're allowed to, as a gairim, in other words, as somebody chopping wood outside that the geisus keeps hearing and it keeps them alive, you're allowed to ask the person to chop wood to stop. So you're removing something that is stopping the natural cycle of life. Is that how you understand the Ramah?
Yes, but I would just back up a second. You mentioned pain. Pain plays a role into a point, but not necessarily. Just because a patient is in pain, does that give us a right to allow the patient to die? So a patient, unfortunately, could be in a lot of pain. if his prognosis is that he may be able to live a while, we might not be able to take the consideration of pain into consideration.
But why not?
Because if the patient is could live, that's something that not necessarily does a person have a right to. In other words, we have a mitzvah to save every person, and not necessarily does pain do that. Again, this is a difference of opinion among poskim. Certain poskim take a more broader approach with pain. Certain poskim take less, and it really has to. Each situation has to be looked at separately. But as far as the second, the Ramah that you mentioned, yes, if a patient is potentially at the end of their life and the life-sustaining measures that you are doing are just sort of prolonging the end with no hope of them ever getting out of the situation that they're in, then there is an idea that we would be allowed to withhold some of that treatment that is just prolonging the ultimate end result.
Rabbi Eliezer, what would you say? Okay. Well, Rabbi Wurzman, thank you very much. We're going to be speaking to a few other Rabbanim on this. But my takeaway is that in matters of Pikuach Nefesh, which by Kval Yisrael is the most Chamer Halachas, you're allowed to be Fakhenes Agal B'Shabbos, somebody who has moments to live the halacha is, even for Chayisha, this is, do not try this at home and call your Rav every step of the way. And 1718 Chayim Aruchim would be a way to reach you when, Rachman Ol Tzvan, we have cases like that.
Thank you very much. It's 718 Aruchim is the number. And thank you very much for inviting me and allowing me to share some of the experiences.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Gwartzman. Vice President of the Agudas Yisrael, he's also the President of Chaim Aruchim, Isaac B'tzarchei Tzibur B'amunah, Rav Shmuel Lefkowitz. Shalom Aleichem, Rav Shmuel.
Aleichem Shalom, Rav David.
Can you tell us what is the mission of Chaim Aruchim?
The mission of Chaim Aruchim is to take care and make sure that seriously ill people, although they can't be cured, are treated and are alive as long as the Rabbeinu Shlomo wants them to live, rather than being told that it's not worth doing this treatment or that treatment, or why mucha. There's all kinds of values today that says that if a person can't play them, but according to the Torah, we're mechuyev to keep a person alive. We're not allowed to do anything that will shorten their life. So Chaim Aruchim is there to help them, both mitzad halacha and also mitzad being able to figure out whether or not what the doctor is saying is the actual truth, or is this doctor always telling people not to continue, and maybe there's another doctor in the facility who could help. So this is what Chaim Aruchim basically does through its 24-hour hotline. And the Rabbanim are trained in both aspects, both in terms of the halacha and also in terms of being able to thaw out whether or not what is real here. Is the patient, taka, can't be cured, there's nothing, can't be treated, there's nothing more to do, or is there really something more to do? And they make suggestions based on their experience because they know that a patient under these conditions could be treated. So this is basically what Chaim Aruchim is doing.
We start Rabbi Lefkowitz, if somebody has a critically ill a loved one in the hospital and all kinds of questions about do not resuscitate, end of life, feeding tube, intubation, etc., they should pick up the phone and call Chaim Aruchim, who are the experts in this topic.
Right, 718 Aruchim. And the Rabbanim there are trained, like I said before, by doctors. They had a year and a half training, plus a lot of shimush, ongoing shimush, and being involved in this. So they're trained already to listen with the, like they say, the fifth of Shulchan Aruch, David. I'm sure you know about that. And to listen and to hear in between the lines sometimes what is really going on, or to suspect that what's being heard from the doctor is not real. Also, our people are trained to talk to the doctor. The patient's family usually don't really understand the issues, and when they try to give it over to us, it's very often it's not accurate. And without accurate information, you can't paskin and you can't make suggestions.
Now, Rabbi Lefkowitz, very often, how many calls do you get a month?
We're getting 350. It's up to about 400 calls a month, and each call is not just a call. It's a call with a follow up, and it's become a very, very big issue. And I get an email copy of all the calls, and I see sometimes it's just unbelievable how many emails I get that there was a call came into the Chaim Aruchim hotline. It's very busy and it's very time consuming. And it takes, and some of our people are, one of our people, in fact, was even, worked after the Shkia on a Friday afternoon. It was a Pikuach Nefesh issue. So we're there for the people, and we have a great team of people, Paiskim mainly, and who really care, and also two people who help with the discharge issues, because after the person leaves the hospital, or if a person has to leave the hospital doesn't want to treat, where do we take that person to? We have two people, Penny Most and Mrs. Leah Horowitz, who are very expert on the knowing where is the best facility for the people. So we try our best, Baruch Hashem, to Nachas Ruach being involved in this. And Gedalia Weinberger is the chairman of the board, and Rivi Schwebel is involved. There are people, a lot of Balabatim involved, and Baruch Hashem, we're doing a service that...
Rav Shmuel, what inspired you to start Chaim Aruchim?
Many, many years ago, I was asked to serve on the board of Metropolitan Jewish Health System, and I saw a lot of services that they have that the Frum community wasn't necessarily taking part of. And also, I learned a lot about the problems of healthcare. And then put that together with my role in the Aguda, I saw that more and more we were getting calls from hospitals, and the only way the Aguda had to deal with it was through our lawyers. We'd send a lawyer's letter, and it would create a whole problem. We'd end up in court. So I said, there's got to be another way. So combining these two backgrounds, we decided that, I thought of the idea together with Gedalia and others that why not try the good way? In other words, instead of doing everything through the legal system, why not do something through the system of trying to work with people and work with doctors? And surprisingly enough, it works. We went to the biggest doctors to the heads of NYU, the heads of Maimonides, the heads of Mount Sinai, Columbia Presbyterian, and on the top level, people are sympathetic to what we want to do, and we saw that we can through the system, working with the system, working with the people, and letting them know what our values are and what the Torah says, there's respect. There was respectability, and through that we started Chaim Aruchim and said, okay, now we need to help the people. Now that we know that we could help the people, let's figure out how to communicate with them. So we started the 24-hour hotline. You can't start a 24-hour hotline without having experienced the people in halacha and in the medical matter. So one thing led to the other.
Well, thank you very much, Reb Shmuel. And Rabbi Yisholm should give you and your organization the kayach to continue with extraordinary chesed shalemus.
Thank you very much, Reb David, and what you're doing is very important to publicize. In fact, after one of our shows previously, someone listened and they called right away. They said they didn't realize that this is a problem and they were doing things wrong and a patient's family. And so it's you're our shutuf in this Devar Mitzvah.
And again, the phone number is
718 Aruchim. A-R-U-C-H-I-M.
718. Aruchim. Thank you very much, Rav Shmuel.
Thank you.
As we lay.